Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Today we delve into the evolving world of gender identity with Drs. Diane Aaron-Saft and Michelle Jerkowitz, authors of a really interesting new book called Gender Explained, A New Understanding of Identity in a Gender Creative World. Then Rebecca Brenner and Virginia Solomon, board members from Summit Pride, will discuss local informational and support resources for members and allies of Utah's LGBTQIA+ community. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Gender is something that most of us didn't give a lot of thought to in past generations, just seeing it as part of who we are and maybe not that complicated. Well, if you have young people in your life, you've probably discovered that that is no longer the case. From pronouns to name changes to the politics of who can use which bathrooms and compete on which sports teams, gender has begun playing a much bigger role in the cultural limelight. Today, there are not only record number of people identifying as something other than the gender they were assigned at birth, but there are also increasingly new ways for all of us to name, define, and understand gender. Today, we delve into this evolving world of gender identity with Drs. Diane Aaron-Saft and Michelle Jerkowitz, authors of a really interesting new book called Gender Explained, A New Understanding of Identity in a Gender Creative World. Drs. Aaron-Saft and Jerkowitz, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having us.
We're delighted to be here.
Well, let's start with a working definition of gender. What is gender and how is it related to one's sexual preference?
So gender and one's sexual preference are not the same thing. So we think about gender as more of an internal identity, how one feels about themselves or how they express that gender in the way they dress and their gestures and hairstyles. We think about biological sex as the sex designated at birth, which is usually determined by a baby's genitals. And then we think about sexual preference more so. I think what you're referring to is who are attracted to, like sexual orientation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Only because sometimes it feels like people conflate those things and it's really quite distinctive, right?
It is, because one is about one's own identity and the other is about what gender or genders somebody is attracted to in others.
I see. So for many adults, this seems to be coming out of the blue. This is just like, why is there so much all of a sudden? But it's not really that all of a sudden, is it?
I would say every culture has had gender as part of how they organize themselves. It's just a question of how they do it. This has been evolving for a long time. This being, you know what? Actually, gender doesn't live in just two boxes, boy, girl, male, female, man, woman. It's a rainbow. There is an infinite variety of the ways people can both know who they are as male, female, or other, or how they want to do it, how they want to express themselves. So we've had the seeds of this going way back in our culture, and certainly it got fomented in the 1960s, if we go back there, to the women's movement and youth culture, where gender norms were shaken up and broken all over the place. And typically it was about how gender was expressed. And then it evolved into, well, it's not just how you express gender, it's also how you know yourself to be inside your identity. And it feels very new, but I think, and it is in the way that an evolution has exploded into a revolution, a new youth revolution. The kids are our teachers on this, and we follow behind learning about how to rethink gender.
That's so interesting. What is it that is so important about gender expression that makes people feel authentic or inauthentic?
The first thing that comes to mind is gender expression influences how others respond to you. And so if somebody expresses their gender in a way that others interpret as boy, girl, or non-binary, or any other gender, then it helps to mirror back the person's internal identity, which makes them feel much more secure And sane, right? Because it can feel very disorienting if how I feel internally is not at all what the world is reflecting back to me. And I think gender expression has a lot of influence on that.
And it really emphasizes that no person is an island, that we live in the context of our family, when we're children, our schools, our community, our country, and beyond. And so there's a feedback loop in terms of what we call gender health. It's not just that you get to be who you are, it's that others let you be who you are or express yourself the way you want to, which is why we wrote this book, because we thought this is a time to help everybody realize that. So everybody can have what we call gender health, whatever your gender is.
Hmm. There is a term that you used in the book, gender noise. And I've heard that term noise in recent months about like Ozempic and stuff. People are talking about these GLP-1 drugs as quieting the food noise, and that some people have this constant awareness of just being hungry or having a craving for things. And I never heard that in the context of gender.
I actually learned this concept from Aidan Olsen Kennedy, who was the one who derived the idea and taught about it, that in our heads, while we may be sitting at our desk trying to study, some other thoughts may be running around that we can't stop, and they get louder and louder and they fill up the space. And that's so true for many children and youth who are either transgender, gender exploring, non-binary, whatever their gender may be, that is outside those two boxes that we planted a long time ago, they get preoccupied with that. And they get preoccupied because of the feedback loop. They're wondering, how are people seeing me? Will they see me correctly? Will they say the correct pronouns? Will somebody start to give me grief? Will somebody expose me in my classroom? And I prefer to be private, whatever it may be, it takes up all the space inside, so you can't concentrate on your studies. And this is what so many youth suffer from, and adults as well, is this kind of gender noise that just puts a damper on living your life fully if you're always having to talk to those voices inside, imagine what's coming next.
There was also a concept that I really responded to, that instead of thinking about gender on just maybe a linear scale, that we should consider it in a 3D or even 4D model as a gender web to kind of reapproach the whole idea of gender. Can you share a little bit about that concept?
Well, as we say in our book, In Gender Explained, this is a concept that Diane created because the spectrum was just, it wasn't capturing everything. It was quite two-dimensional. And so the idea of a gender web is that there are all these threads that each of us have that we're constantly weaving together. And the threads are made up of nature, nurture, culture, all of that combined with the aspect of time, that all of this varies across time. And so the idea of the gender web is that we each have a unique gender web. And in this way, all of our genders are slightly different, whether it's how we identify our genders, experience our genders, express them, it varies, and it can vary across a lifetime.
And probably across the cultural shifts that happen within a lifetime too. I mean, Diane, you were mentioning earlier about how in the 60s, men were able to relax some of those hyper-masculine traits. But even you also mentioned in the book in the 1920s and in the post-war period in the 40s, after women started wearing pants and they were going into the workplace, those changed too. So is this partially a product of more of us having abilities to imagine ourselves as a different gender?
Or actually, perhaps I should ask,
how do you think our present culture is affecting people's desire to express themselves in a more creative way?
We have something called gender literacy. And gender literacy is like learning to read differently. as I said before, there has been an evolution rolling out for a long time, and some of it's based on the economy. And for example, look at our workplace now. It looks very different than it did 50 years ago. And no longer is the image of a woman with an apron in the kitchen. And every time there's been a change, and the economy is only one piece of it, it seems to have had effect on our gender understandings, the way we know ourselves. The story I always tell is when I grew up in Chicago, it was very snowy and cold in the winter. Girls were required to wear skirts or dresses, no matter what the weather. And blizzards, ice storms, whatever, skirts. I was telling my granddaughter this in the early 2000s, and she, knowing me as her feminist grandmother, said, "Grandma, why didn't you protest?" We just knew that's just the way it was. And then by the time my younger brother left high school, anybody could wear pants who wanted to wear pants to school, because people learned, why does it have to be this way? And I think there's so many things, science, the economy, learning from other cultures, and just saying, this doesn't feel right. I feel kind of roped up, leads to those kinds of changes.
The times are always changing.
Yes.
Why do you think gender, and especially some of these changes and evolutions of gender, are making some people so very anxious?
Well, I think part of it is that most of us in our culture have experienced gender as foundational. We've kind of structured society around this idea of gender norms and the gender binary. And when we're suddenly faced with this idea that what we thought was just a given is no longer a given, and it kind of shakes everything up. And I think when we see such huge changes, cultural changes, it makes people very, very anxious. Whether it's because they don't understand, or they're afraid of the change, or it really makes them question even their own position in society and how they identify, which can be quite anxiety provoking if you've thought you've just always known.
Wow. Yeah. Kind of like a family member of someone who's gone through addiction, who they then reflect on their own habits and their own patterns in their lives and notice things. So it's kind of creating an opportunity for reflection that's making some people nervous. And some people are just afraid of upsetting the status quo or the social construct, I imagine. Yes.
Absolutely. And I think in our book, we try to emphasize how important it is for people to take this opportunity of reflection, to really reflect, because that is what can open up more dialogue and help it feel like we're all in this together versus this, pro-transgender rights, anti-transgender rights, that sort of thing.
Historically, somebody who presented as a gender other than the one on their birth certificate was often subject to negative social consequences, along with even danger. Is that something that you see as changing in our current environment?
I would say it's shifting in both directions. There is so much opportunity that was not there before to express your gender and paint your own canvas about how you want to be. However, there's a lot of people in their anxiety about that who can be very aggressive, hostile, and hurtful. And particularly right now, when gender has become such a controversial issue with, I believe, a lot of misinformation, sometimes disinformation about what's really going on, it puts kids at two places at the same time if they're growing up exploring and expanding gender. One is, this is a wonderful new world, and I feel so good to be able to finally be myself. And the other is, oh, but I'm very aware that there are other people who don't like me being myself. And we see that right now in an upticking of anxiety, since there's been so much more controversy, but also explicit anti-transgender remarks being made by people in power. So we have both, and I would say that I think the sense of contentment, excitement, and expansiveness is winning out in terms of what I call this gender revolution that's occurring.
It feels like that. I've seen a number of grandparents who have referred to their grandchildren in gender neutral terms, or explained very matter of factly that, oh, my grandson was born a girl or whatever. And it's fascinating to see as some folks are able to adapt to the world as it evolves, and other folks are clinging on a little bit to older ways, and it's a little trickier for them. But everyone's trying, and I do see them trying, which is something.
One of the most moving experiences I have had as a clinical psychologist, which really helped me in working with Michelle to write Gender Explain, was running a grandparents group, which I did for several years. And the beauty of it was the grandparents learning from each other. And I've mentioned that the children are leading these new ways of being around gender, but the grandparents have been a vital force. They come from another generation. They're one step removed from the parents, so they can have a wider angle lens. And what I've watched is some grandparents help other grandparents who feel they're on a precipice and moving boulders around gender to take a deep breath and to learn how important their recognition and acknowledgement, not just of their grandchildren, but of their children who are raising the grandchildren and offering them support as those children let their children be free to express their gender and be the gender they are.
Well, that sounds wonderful, that a grandparent group. That is a very powerful behind the scenes cultural element. And, you know, our boomers are a massive part of society right now. They've got a lot of power, and what a wonderful way to use that power. Let's talk a little bit about some of the political issues that come up around gender, especially in a place like Park City. We have a lot of sports, a lot of skiing, a lot of all kinds of Olympic sports. What would you say is a solution to the question of should transgender athletes be able to play on their gender identified team?
Well, in the book, we talk a little bit about this in Gender Explained. And we're really focused on children, those, you know, kids up to 18, maybe young adults. And without a doubt, it seems that kids need to be able to play on the sports team that aligns with their gender identity. All children should have access to sports. We know that it's a protective factor. It builds, you know, important skills, teams building skills, communication. And that young people do much better in school, particularly when we look at transgender youth who are athletes and are able to play on the team that aligns with their gender identity. We find that these young people are doing much better than their transgender peers who are not involved in athletics or not permitted to play on the team that aligns with their gender identity. They tend to have higher grades. They tend to report having more friends. They tend to miss school less often. There's all these ways that it seems that this is protective for them. And on the flip side, we cannot find any significant evidence that it poses any sort of threat or disadvantages cisgender athletes. I think that when we start talking about adults, it may get more complicated. But in terms of the young people, we're very clear that all children should be able to play on the team that aligns with their gender identity.
So what's the argument for the over-the-top parents obsessed with sports who say that a body that has more testosterone in it might be able to develop muscle better than a body that has less? Some of these elements that apparently could create an advantage.
Yes. Well, I mean, we would have to look case by case, but generally what I would say is that a lot of young trans people who are athletes, many of them may have been on blockers and then on hormones, which means, say, they're a trans girl, they may have no more or have been exposed to no more testosterone than a cisgender girl. And so those arguments fall flat because they don't have the physical advantage that people are so worried about. And I think people are mostly worried about the trans girls playing on girl sports rather than the reverse. We don't hear a lot of controversy about trans boys playing on the boys teams.
Yes.
And I would say there's a bell-shaped curve in terms of people's strength, people's agility. If we do simply take designated sex at birth, some are stronger than others, some weaker than others. We have not seen any evidence of transgender youth or adults sweeping away every award and walking away with the trophies. It's not, they're falling out that way. There's actually very few transgender people involved in sports. But what I will say, particularly for youth, is when they're denied or they leave voluntarily because they don't feel comfortable enough and they used to when they were little, it's with great cost to them, that to their mental and physical health. And I don't think we want that for any child.
Absolutely not. So you mentioned earlier that this construct of nature, nurture, culture is all part of what creates this gender web. If you're a parent and you see, or grandparent, and you see a child in your life who seems to be identifying as a different gender, at what point do you address this with the child? Do you wait for them to speak to you? Do you talk with them about it? How would you start if you notice something going on in a child's life that you care about?
Well, I think the first place to start is simply by opening up a conversation with the child and asking. And watching, right? And kind of using your instincts around when is the right moment to open up the conversation. And it might not even be a conversation that happens, you know, the first or second time, but you're conveying that this is something that we can absolutely talk about, that there's not a problem here, that we are interested.
While also it's not a taboo.
Exactly. It's subject. Not a taboo subject. And then I think you're listening to the child and your own internal reactions in determining when and if the family needs help, and whether that's because the child is having distress because of puberty changing their bodies, whether that's because the parents are struggling with how to adjust to changes, or they just need some direction about what to do to best support their children at any of these points. A family can reach out for help, because help in the gender affirmative model or gender affirming care includes all kinds of supports, like therapy for kids, for parents, support groups, educational supports, legal advocacy, and then of course, medicine. So whatever help a family needs, they can reach out for when it feels necessary.
Okay, so it's just being open, being communicative, being responsive.
And I would say, don't tell, ask.
Okay.
And really be a listener and keep pipelines open so that your child feels comfortable and safe enough to initiate the conversation if they'd like it to come from them. And sometimes kids have known for up to 8 years before they say a word to their parents. Or to somebody around them. And that doesn't mean that their parents aren't supportive or accepting. It just means that they needed that time to themselves and it felt very private. Whatever the reason may be, is to, as a parent, know that we are experts as parents of our children, but we also have blind spots in any part of their growing up. And this is a big one. So it's really important to underline that we all need support when we feel off kilter, off balance, particularly with something with our child. and a place to sort that out. And we write in the book about gender angels and gender ghosts that we all have. And the gender angels are the part of us that help us take in what our child is telling us and be right there with them. And the gender ghosts are the whispers who are saying, this is just wrong. And no, I will never take them for medical care because that will just lead them down a slope into Hades or wherever that slope may take you, wherever that chute may take you. And those voices can get louder and louder as you get more worried about what to do for your child. So I just want to emphasize how much support adults need in adjusting to what I call this new zeitgeist of gender and what we talk about in the book about the new zeitgeist of gender.
So true. As this is becoming such a topic of conversation in a lot of different areas of culture right now, one of the things that comes up for me a lot is that every generation seems to have a thing that they're breaking down. Part of their zeitgeist, part of their mission is to break down this dyadic cycle that's been
such a part of our world.
There's always going to be a mountain to climb and way to find more liberty for people. At least helps me a little bit. You mentioned in the book, it's not only about responding to somebody who has gender questioning or a shift in their gender. It's about your own reflection and how we as individuals can become more conversant, more aware of gender in our own identities. If you're a person who never really saw this as an issue in your life or you're questioning, what should we do to be more open and to examine this in a different way?
Well, I think one place to start is reflecting on your own gender in terms of, you know, how did you come to know your gender? You know, these questions that we've never asked ourselves, you know, has there ever been a time that I felt limited by my prescribed gender role? What about these changing gender norms makes me feel anxious? What am I worried is going to happen? To just take the time to reflect on that internally about oneself, and I think it's also about reflecting on our internal experiences in reaction to other people. We give an example in the book about, you know, seeing somebody in the grocery store aisle who has this wearing a dress, but a big bushy beard, and like what comes up inside of you, you know, is it interest and curiosity? Is it disgust or fear? And to recognize that none of these feelings are in and of themselves wrong, like all feelings are acceptable. But then it's about understanding where are these feelings coming from and making sure that we're not acting from places that we haven't thought about and reflected on.
All right. So staying conscious of our own responses to things that we see around us and maybe our own triggers or histories that could be informing those things. Well, as we wrap up today, we've been talking on The Mountain Life with the authors of a great new book called Gender Explained, A New Understanding of Identity in a Gender Creative World. Is there any parting thoughts you'd like to leave for our listeners as they move through the world as it continues to evolve in relation to gender?
I think we should recognize that we have moved from gender as bedrock to gender as moving boulders, and that we're all working and getting our footing, and the younger people are steadier on their feet about this than we are. So learning from them, I would just want to underline and to recognize that in every era of history, when there's been a radical change, there's been a disruption, there have been blowbacks and people saying, no, no, that can't be, that can't be. And if we can just take a deep breath and say, it is, this is what we're learning. Gender as infinite rather than just coming in twos.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this interesting discussion. And we really just scratched the surface. There is so much in this book, Gender Explained. It is an education and in a wonderful way. Thank you so much, doctors. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary Beth.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. I'm speaking today with Rebecca Brenner and Virginia Solomon, two pillars of our community who have some great resources for people who are of the LGBTQIA+, I hope I didn't miss anything, community, as well as those who love them and support them. This morning, we talked earlier with the authors of a new book called Gender Explained, and we thought it would be helpful to bring some local community members together to tell us about ways you can find more information or support if you're looking for it. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us, Mary Beth.
Of course. Well, maybe we could just start with a little bit about yourselves. Rebecca, you're part of our Park City community, and I know you through some school things with our kids, but what brought you to working in this area?
Yeah, so I am a mom. I have two kiddos, and one of my kiddos is trans non-binary. And I have always been really just excited by learning about him and learning about his journey. And that has brought me into work with Summit Pride and really the great LGBTQIA+ community that we have here in Park City and Summit County.
Wonderful. And how about you, Virginia?
Yeah, so I am a trans non-binary person and involved in a queer relationship. I got kind of involved in queer politics actually in high school. My high school had a volunteer requirement and we had kind of a family connection to the local gay men's health center in Washington, D.C., which unfortunately in the mid-90s was the main site for the provision of HIV/AIDS health. And so before I even sort of myself knew about my identity, was aware of and had firsthand experience with the personal and structural problems that queer people face in our society, which have made advances in the last, I don't want to do the math, number of years, 30, I guess, but also I think we're seeing some real threats to those advances coming up. So kind of brought that awareness and also the academic interests that I have in queer art and politics to want to get involved and make my local community better for myself and the people in it.
Wonderful. So this has been a part of your life for quite a long time then.
I guess so. Thanks for saying that on the radio.
Sorry. Well, one of the things we wanted to talk about today was if a family has some gender issues going on with themselves, with their children, what would be some of the things that they could do to reach?
Well, I almost wonder,
I
even instead of saying gender issues, what if we think about it as gender opportunities, right? That I think, Well, and it was just something that occurred to me. But I know, I'm speaking for myself and Rebecca, the expansive opportunity to really be yourself 100% and really be making choices absolutely about kind of how you want to be and how you want to interact with the world. I think that we see it in relationship to the very real institutional challenges that people might face. But what if we flip that lens and think about that as opportunities instead?
I think that's terrific, because when one does enter one of these groups or support mechanisms, it's always such a surprise at how fun and lively and connective it is. It's not meant to be prescriptive. It's meant to be a lively, robust community.
Yeah, I love that.
Rebecca, I know that that you have a group that meets on a regular basis. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think that Summit County and Park City, there are lots of growing resources. I think that, just in general as a city and a county, we at Summit Pride have been in touch with city leaders and county leaders who have been sharing with us their support and how much they support the safety and equity of everybody in our community, including the LGBTQIA+ community. And so part of that work stems from, well, all of that work actually stems from Summit Pride. And so this little sort of offshoot of Summit Pride has become the parent group. And the parent group really was started as sort of what we were all just talking about, right? That, you know, your child may share with you that they are somewhere on that spectrum of the letters. And we wanted, I wanted specifically to create a group that was celebratory of that, that this was something that you could come into this community of parents and adults who were celebrating who their children were. They were celebrating that their kids felt safe enough to share who they truly were with you. And then also to make a safe space in that group where, yeah, if you have concerns about the politics at large, that can seem scary and overwhelming, or challenges within the school district, or challenges with neighbors or sports teams or coaches, that as a group, we could sort of resource one another and support one another in any of those challenges. But really, the core of the group is that it's a celebration that your kiddo is learning about who they are, and that they're brave enough to share that and excited and trust you enough with that information.
That sounds a little different from some of the groups that are out there. I know many families are glad to embrace a child or a teenager who is finding their identity, but some families have trouble and they see it as maybe a traumatic event or something that is a little bit more negative. And so this group is different in that definition, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I want to honor everyone's experience, but for me and my family, as I shared at the beginning, it really was a joyful moment when our young child was discovering who they were and that they trusted our family enough to share that and to have the space to unfold in the ways that they want to unfold. And so it really was a celebration. And a lot of times sharing that information with people outside the family at first, we would come up against some of the things that you were just sharing, Mary Beth, that there was some type of trauma around that. And for us, there wasn't at all. And so we wanted to create a group of parents that kind of felt the same way that we did. And if not, be a resource for parents who maybe aren't there yet, but show them that there is another way of seeing and being.
Oh, wonderful. Now, Virginia, you are the head of Summit Pride. Is that correct?
I think I'm officially the board chair.
The board
we
chair.
We try to be as non-hierarchical as possible while still keeping the lights on, metaphorically.
Fair enough.
So sure.
And tell us a little bit about Summit Pride. How long has it been around? What kind of things is it doing as an organization?
Absolutely. And I think I would be remiss to not highlight that our website is summitpride.org, and we have an email list that you can sign up for through that website. But really, we were an organization that started in Park City Municipal upon realizing that they actually had a quite shockingly low score in the Human Rights Campaign Municipal Equality Index that they do of cities around the country. And that score, I think it was 17 out of 100 or something like that, didn't jive with the city's identity around our values and the importance that we place on equality and equity. And so the city convened an internal task force to try and look at different things that they could do to try and raise that score. And we're able to raise it up, I think it was to 86. It was 86 2 years ago, and I think we lost a point and got down to 85 last year. But that's basically as high as a city of our size can get. To get those extra 15 points are just of a scale of municipal resources that Park City doesn't have. And so I think that's something that we all can be really proud of. And then as the group started to engage with the larger community more, it just sort of grew to a scale and to involve, you know, folks out in the basin, outside of just what city organizations do. And so we spun off, took different kinds of iterations, and then were able to launch as our own 501c3 with a new, snappy, less cumbersome name this summer.
Nice. And is it an event-driven organization, or an advocacy, or just kind of everything that relates to the LGBTQIA+ community?
Yeah, no, thanks for giving an opportunity to talk about that as well. I think we think about what we do as operating in two lanes. One is a kind of community building lane for us that historically has included predominantly social events, but we're looking to do a lot more in terms of sort of know your rights type events, legal aid type organizing, things like that. There'll be resources that we'll have available for folks. If you need sort of queer family law or help with things like changing gender identity, you know, identification markers, things like that. And so that's the kind of community building lane. And then we have an advocacy lane as well. And so we have productively partnered with Equality Utah for a lot of that. If you have listeners who have businesses that want to have equity trainings, Equality Utah is a great organization and it has great trainings on different aspects of DEI stuff. And then advocating with local businesses and with the city and the county around needs for the queer community. We're lucky to be in a community where we're not fighting battles to change hearts and minds so much as we are just educating people of goodwill and good hearts who might just not necessarily know how to best support their LGBTQIA plus employees and family members and things like that. And so we definitely exist as a resource for people to reach out to if you have questions, if there are policies that you want to know about. For example, after the last legislative session, we worked quite closely with the city and the county around brainstorming ideas to comply with the new bathroom legislation that, you know, complied with the law, but that was as sort of least harmful as that compliance could be. So we do things like that as well. So again, these sort of two lanes, a community building lane and an outreach and advocacy lane.
Oh, wonderful. Well, my husband and I attended the gala that the Equality Utah folks had down in Salt Lake, I think it was last month, and it was a ball. So these are fun parties. If you're just wanting to get involved in some way, do not miss them. So they are a good partner for you.
We don't like to traffic in stereotypes, but you know, we throw a good party.
Sorry. Well, at least that's a good stereotype to have, maybe.
Exactly. Exactly. We don't hate it.
Are some of these resources, are they listed on the summitpride.org site, or is it things that we come in and speak with folks in person, or how do things work?
So we're working on getting that resource page up there. With our rebrand we did this summer, we got a new logo and a new name. We're working on a new website. I think anyone who's done one knows that it always takes longer than you want it to. But there will be a resource page. I think it's pretty easy to get that up on our Squarespace now that we've gotten some organization around that. But certainly in the meantime, please do email us, go to that summitpride.org website, sign up for our email list. I personally will reply and say, hey, do you want to be on a list that just notifies you about our events? Do you want to be on our regular meeting agenda update kind of a list, that sort of thing? And so we can tailor you to get the communications that you want and not get the ones that you don't want.
Well, we all have so many communications hitting us from every direction. I think that's really
exactly
smart.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Is this something that general allies should or can be a part of, or is it more for people who are right in the center of the action?
Yeah, I would say it's absolutely for allies as well. Yeah, so people that are in the center of the action, people that are allies, people that are in the LGBTQIA plus community, if you are interested, join in. There's a lot to do. And they're like Virginia was saying, you know, there's we're building events. We have our Pride event is it June, Virginia, is that?
Yes.
Yes, we have our Pride event in June. And so it's for everybody who wants to be involved.
Great. Got it. Virginia, you mentioned some of the new bathroom bills, and we always seem to be having interesting things popping up in our legislature. Is there anything at the moment that you're really asking for extra involvement or advocacy for?
Yeah, absolutely. In our current environment, legislation against trans individuals and trans children in particular seems to be getting quite a lot of media attention, and unfortunately has proven to be a very, very successful organizing and fundraising tool for certain sectors of our political environment. And so we're keeping an eye out on more kind of trans sports legislation. We're keeping an eye out on more bathroom legislation. We're keeping an eye out on gender affirming care access, on ability to change identification and gender markers, things like that, that unfortunately are kind of stepping stones to the rollback to other rights that we've been able to achieve in terms of, you know, marriage equality, adoption rights, things like that. There's pretty awful things happening in Florida, which oftentimes is a playbook for other red states in terms of just labeling people as trans as sex offenders and all of the repercussions that redound from that. And so there's definitely things that we have to organize around. There's a lot to do. There is a lot that allies can do to get back, Mary Beth, to the question that you asked earlier. Friendly phone calls that let legislators know that they have constituents who care about these kinds of things can do a world of good for folks who might only hear the loud and scary voices, right? And so there's definitely a lot to be done in this particular environment and specific things that we're organizing around.
Yeah, and I would second that with the allies, that I think that any allies that are listening, I would, you know, encourage you to really get involved and to make your voice heard, that you are an ally on city and county and state levels, because it's really important that allies are sharing how they feel and they're not just kind of keeping it to themselves or talking amongst their friends, that they really need to be a part of the political action to help support our LGBTQIA plus friends and family.
And to add on to what Rebecca was saying as well, that there is stuff that folks can do that is maybe kind of direct and obvious, writing letters, calling people, giving public comment, that kind of thing. But I think also just an awareness that being present in the community makes a big difference, right? If you say are at your bowling league, right, and you hear people talking about what they read in the news that morning, there's a space to say, oh yeah, you know, I hear your experience and I hold space for your experience, but let me share with you my experience and let me share with you why that doesn't hold true to what I see with my friends and family, or why actually I see that hurting my friends and family. You know, that's work that allies can do that is really important and helpful in terms of kind of changing hearts and minds.
And I think it's something that you can practice it, you know, start small if you need to and gain the courage. But, you know, at dinner parties, like Virginia said, out at a restaurant or bowling, practice being brave and sharing a different perspective and really being a voice as an ally.
I love the way both of you just approached that, because I think what we're seeing so much in the divisive culture right now is that people are losing the ability to have constructive dialogue, and they're finding that maybe if I'm just not even going to fight over it because I'm not going to get through to these people on the other side for me. And so by opening up to saying, I hear your experience, I acknowledge what you're going through, I'm not going to come out guns blazing, even if it might have a very good and just reason. But that strikes me as one of the best ways, is just to kind of create more opportunities for civil productive dialogue. Is that something that is happening everywhere, or is that especially in Utah?
In terms of the presence of civil dialogue or the apparent absence of civil dialogue?
Well, just, I mean, is it a movement that we're seeing in pride groups everywhere, or is that something that you particularly are championing here?
I think historically, we have seen the most success when we don't come out belittling people. Right? There's, you know, science that shows that if you come at someone with facts that are contrary to their own deeply held personal beliefs, it actually retrenches them further in their position because it paints you as an unreliable interlocutor, I guess. So hearing people, letting them know that, you know, you don't think that they're evil, but that you hold a difference of opinion that's based on your own experiences of the world, kind of is a more successful way to communicate. So I think that a lot of our civil rights advances have shown a balance between calling out injustice when we see it and not dismissing the people who might be engaged with perpetrating that injustice just immediately out of hand.
Yeah, that's a great distinction between the behavior and the person, to try to find a steady ground in there.
I think that's an interesting place too, where all people, but, you know, talking about allies here, where you can just educate yourself. And I think that if you educate yourself on, you know, with your guests that you had earlier and the book that they wrote and the experience of LGBTQIA plus people, listening to them, learning about what they're sharing, as an ally, the more educated you are, and then you're out in the world living your life and somebody might say something, you can be calm and present and embodied and just share like, oh, that's incorrect, and let me share with you why. And it doesn't have to be defensive or angry. It's just a clear, kind sharing of what is correct. And so I think educating yourself as an ally is a great way to be an ally.
And understanding that these aren't just LGBTQ issues. I think actually Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said it really well in response to the conversation around the trans folks' access to bathrooms at the U.S. Capitol after the election of the first trans member of Congress, the Sarah McRide of Delaware, that this isn't a trans issue. It impacts everybody, right? That you, I don't know if your listeners will see a picture of you and your lovely haircut, but that you have long hair, but that the next person might not want to have long hair, and that's fine. Who cares, right? But someone actually might be able to care if we're starting policing who's in a bathroom. These kinds of things, what we like to point out, same things with the bathrooms, not having single stall bathrooms hurts people who might need extra help in the bathroom. It hurts people with kids who might need a little bit of extra help in the bathroom, whatever the case might be. Recognizing that there are issues that impact all of us if we're just able to step back and recognize that kind of shared experience that we have.
Absolutely. And so often the slippery slope is a very good analogy. You know, we let some things go and suddenly so many civil rights are being impinged upon. So it is important to catch them early. Well, is there any last parting thoughts you'd like to let listeners know about Summit Pride or anything coming up, or just a thought of the day?
I think just to reiterate, if you want to be involved, if you have questions, either sort of personal questions or things with your business or organization, please do reach out. You can get to us at snubitpride.org, and we're here to really build up this community of queer folks who live in Summit County and people who want to support us.